Hi, everybody. My name is Nick, and I'm an alcoholic. Amen. We'll try that again. Hi, everybody. Try to make this interactive a little bit. I never know what I'm going to say when I open my mouth, so you'll just have to all bear with me. I was told that this is supposed to make me nervous, and it does. And when it makes doesn't make you nervous anymore, stop doing it. So here I am doing it, so I'm nervous. My sobriety date is Saturday, 1967. Saturday, I'll have 44 years, if I live that long. That's 16,000, and we do it a day at a time. That's 16,068 days. I figured it out this afternoon, if anybody's counting. Before I talk about my favorite subject, which is me, I'd like to give you a little history of young people's groups in Tampa. I was a member of the first young people's group in Tampa in 1968. There were seven of us. That's all we could find. And we had to make it 40 and under to find seven, because John was almost 40. So, there was John and Barbara. They were married. There was my wife and at the time and myself. There was Herb, who was a doctor. Herb and Barbara were the only two that had jobs. There was Kenny, I almost said his last name. Kenny, who I used to run with, we used to go into meetings and pick arguments just so we could hear people fight. And Kenny carried a gun. and his girlfriend, and that was the seven of us. None of us had any jobs except Herb, who was the doctor, and Barbara, who worked at the TV station. So they each put in a dollar, and we all took turns stealing it. I think we were self-supporting through Herb's contributions. We grew over. I left here in the late 70s, but over that period of time, we grew to a few people. There was probably 15 or 20 of us. As far as I know, most of us are still sober. Two of us got drunk and really did it up. One fell off a stage and got hurt, and they gave him some morphine. And the last time we saw him, we used to call it jelly beans. He was carrying a bag of pills, and they found him. He drowned in about 3 inches of water out here at University of South Florida. And the other fella had a thing about guns, and he got drunk, and he'd been sober a few months, and he got drunk, and his kids came home, and he shot them, and his wife came home, and he shot her, and then he shot himself. You were talking about things that will wake you up. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that God is in everything or he's in nothing, and God was in that, whether we like it or not. And a lot of us, I'm sure, are standing around not drinking because of what happened to these two people. Now for my favorite subject. And that's the history of young people as I know it in Tampa. There probably wasn't this many people in Alcoholics Anonymous in Tampa in that time, so as many as sitting in this hall. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't have much to do with anything else. I took a couple of bennies a time or two, but the gin didn't do anything for me after I took them bennies, so I quit that stuff. But you know, most of the drugs that y'all are familiar with weren't even invented when I was drinking. I was sitting back there thinking LSD. There was pot, of course, but there was no crack. There was no ecstasy. Most of the stuff was not available. And I grew up in Vermont, and back there, if you smoked pot, you were riding a motorcycle back in those days, swinging a chain. My old man was a drunk. I attended my first meeting. Actually, I've been going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous since 1947. I've attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw this little baby over here in 1947 with my father. And we were there to help because my father needed help. We thought that's why we were there, but my father didn't stay sober. My father ended up, when I was 13 years old, he ended up hanging himself in a church in Connecticut. And I was never going to be like that son of a bitch. You know, I was never going to drink like them. I was not going to drink. And I didn't until the first time I got a chance. I was 16 years old, and we went to Rouse's Point, New York, because you could drink in New York. And I have drank Four Roses, mixed it with Pepsi-Cola. That Four Roses hit my stomach. And, you know, I always wanted to be a badass and never felt like one. And that stuff hit, that Four Roses hit the pit of my stomach, and I became an instant badass. I could dance and talk, and I wasn't afraid of anything. Unfortunately, I had a fight that night. I had a blackout that night. I had a little problem with the cops that night. And it was previews of coming attractions. Because over the next 10 years, I was going to have plenty of blackouts, lots of fights, none of which I won, by the way. And I got the scars to prove it. And quite a bit of problems with the police. Never did any real hard time, but I've been in enough that I know what it's like in there. That was the best that my drinking ever was. That night was the best that my drinking ever was. I never felt quite like as much of a badass after that as I did that night. Alcohol never gave me the same charge that it gave me that first night again, but it always gave me just enough to keep me coming back, you know, because I kept hunting that same damn feeling, you know. I graduated from high school, I think because they wanted to get me out. Incidentally, it was the same high school that Dr. Bob graduated from, St. Johnsbury Academy in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. And he went on to Harvard or someplace. I went on to the Navy. I joined the Navy, got married on leave from boot camp. Of course, when you're making $85 a month, hell, you got to get married, you know. Got married. Stationed at Green Cove Springs, Florida was my first adventure into Florida. I spent a year there. I took a job at the Enlisted Men's Club, tending bar. It was $1.05 an hour, if I remember, and all the beer I could drink. I have a friend down here, Bill, and Bill likes to fight, and I was bartending one night, and this guy came in there, and he says, "I've whipped everybody's ass on this whole base." And I said, "You ain't whipped mine." And he said, "Well, come on outside." And so I went outside, and about 2 minutes later, he'd whipped mine. That's this scar right here. The only move I made was to take my glasses off. It turned out he was the Golden Gloves champ for the state of New York. So, but anyway, I had some adventures in the Navy. Misadventures, I guess would be more like it. I went in the Navy. They wanted to make me an officer. When I came out of the Navy, I was washing dirty underwear, pushing underwear into the laundry. I was an E-4, which is a miracle all by itself. And I did get an honorable discharge. In that time, at 19, and here's another sign. At 19, I had a fight with a big purple cockroach, a huge purple cockroach. It was in my car. It filled up my car. I was in dress blues, and when I got done fighting, and I was in Vermont, away, I think in a little town called West Burke, and it was really cold, and by the time I got through fighting that cockroach, I was soaking wet with sweat, and you know, normal drinkers don't usually find purple cockroaches in their car to start with. But I was to go on drinking. I got out of the Navy in 1963, went back to Vermont, ended up getting a job with the state of Vermont, driving their book wagon. And I held that job and I was making $56 a week. And I was working by this time I had two kids and another one on the way. And I took a part-time job working in a grocery store for another dollar. I was $1.05 an hour again. I was making a lot of progress. I spent a lot of time in the produce cooler because that's where they kept the beer. I was always wrapping lettuce. And we never ran out of lettuce, but we did run out of beer. I ended up losing the job with the Vermont Free Public Library because I got a DUI, and then when you get a DUI, the state of Vermont doesn't like you driving their vehicles. One little funny story about that, I was at a Vermont library convention, and I remember the bartender saying, "Man, I didn't know these librarians drank so much," and I was the only one in the bar. And I was giving them a bad reputation, so I guess they were probably glad I was gone. I don't know. Anyway, the state of Vermont decided to rehabilitate me. And, of course, I had done a little time in jail with the DUI. But they decided to rehabilitate me, so I went down to the employment office, and they said they had some classes, mechanics classes. And I said, "Well, as a mechanic, I'd make a good cook." And they said, "Well, we have some cooking classes, too." And I said, "Really? Yeah. We got two different kinds, European and American in cooking." And I said, "Well, what's the difference?" And they said, "The Europeans cook with wine." I did not become an American chef. I learned how to cook with wine. The poor chef, the class was for 26 weeks. It paid me $75 a week. I got a raise. I got a DUI and got a raise. And they paid for the school. But the chef had one hell of a, and all of us were alike. There was 20-something of us in this class. We all did the same thing. And he poured enough salt in that wine, and it didn't even slow us down. You know, I was telling a story, I don't remember where, but I was telling a story. We had to put a dinner on for the Kennedys in Stowe, Vermont, this big ski resort. It was a 7-course meal. In between each course, they served wine. And they had all us students in the kitchen, but of course they weren't letting us do any cooking because they didn't want us to ruin the meal, but they had us in the kitchen doing dishes and this kind of stuff, and they had a conveyor belt. And as these dirty dishes came through here, all these wine glasses came through here, and those guys didn't drink at all. I mean, you know, they aren't like me. They sip their wine, they send it on because they know they got more coming, you know. We finished it for them, of course, you know. And by the time that dinner was over, there was a lot of students that staggered out of that place. But I managed to get through the school, tried to get a job. My chef said I was the best student in the class, but I had a problem with drinking. And so the only offers I could get for work was to, they'd pay me half my pay every week, and at the end of the season, because they wanted to make sure they hung on to me, they'd give me the rest of my money, and man, I couldn't take a job like that. And so I wouldn't take a job. I ended up getting a job in a little town called Lisbon, New Hampshire. I came out of this school qualified to be a fry cook and dishwasher, and I took a job as a chef in this hotel in Lisbon, New Hampshire. And my boss liked to drink, and I, of course, moved all my wine bottles into the kitchen. His wife didn't like him drinking, so he moved into my kitchen, and I moved into his bar. We kind of traded places. I remember one day I forgot to take the hamburger. I was about half shot, and I forgot to take the hamburger out of the freezer, and I'm chopping hamburger, trying to make a hamburger, and I still got the scar where I stuck that boning knife into my arm. And I let go, and it stood up. You know? But you know, you don't feel a whole lot of pain when you're like that. I wrapped a rag around and kept on working, you know. In this time, I had the most serious problem that I had with the police, and the most serious problem that I had obeying the laws in these days was that I had a propensity to steal cars. I would park my car, and of course I didn't have a driver's license, but I would park my car where I absolutely knew where it was, and I couldn't find it. I never could find it. So what I would do is I would take the first car that was available that had a key in it, and I'd just drive it wherever I was going. The first time I did this was in this little town of St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and it didn't have a key in it, so I just was parked on a hill, and I coasted it down the hill, turned right past the police station, and pulled off to the next left up on the curb. It was a one-way street past the police station. The guy called the cops because his car had been stolen. They pulled the cruiser out, and, of course, I'm sitting right there. Cop opened the door, and I hit him between the eyes. You know, I didn't know who he was, you know. And I don't know what that blue light was anyway, you know. I don't think it was even blue in those days. But anyway, they locked me up for a while, and they didn't treat me very nice either. They kind of whooped on me a little bit. And I got a, all I got, ended up with a ticket. I ended up paying a fine for driving while my license was suspended. It's a town where I knew everybody. But another time, I was in Massachusetts, Ipswich, Massachusetts, and by this time I was living in a flop house, and the bar was downstairs. I used to, I never had enough beer money, and this, there was a prostitute that worked in this place, and she used to give me a couple of six-packs of beer to stand watch for her, so I'd stand watch for her with a, with my two six-packs, and it was, I was a pretty good watchman the first six-pack, but the second one, I wasn't worth a shit anymore, and, you know, but she kept doing it anyway, and, but I came, I was in this bar drinking, and this is a five-day blackout I was on, and I came out, and I don't know when I left. I don't know where I got the car that I was driving, but I came to, and I was crossing the Canadian border in Vermont, and I was driving a car I'd never seen before, and I didn't have a driver's license, and I turned around at customs and headed back south, and when I came to, when I came out of the blackout, I was walking through Vermont carrying some clothes on a hanger, and I don't know to this day where I got that car or where the hell I left it. And if you don't think that doesn't cause you some anguish when the phone rings or the doorbell rings or whatever. I was telling that story in a Salem jail one time years and years ago, and probably 1967. And this guard in the back of the room said, "That was my damn car." And, another time I almost wet my pants. I was not a very successful drinker, as you can tell. The disease of alcoholism, as I understand it, and boy, I really identify with the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism, as it was told to me, is threefold. It's physical, mental, and spiritual. And the physical part of this disease is that once I put a drink in my system, I no longer have control over what I'm going to do. And folks, boy, I proved that to, you know, I would try to, I was listening to this fella trying to get off, trying to stop. And I would try to stop drinking, but there was this big hole in my stomach. And I would walk around for days with this damn hole in my stomach, and I'd pour Coke in it and milk and Pepsi and lemonade and anything else, but nothing would fill that damn hole. And finally I'd say, "To hell with this," and I'd pour a beer in it, and the hole would go away. But of course now I got to chase it with more, because once I got one, you know, I never could figure out how anybody could have two beers and then eat apple pie. It just never made any sense to me. You know? But anyway, the second part of the disease of alcoholism, that it, this physical part is coupled with a mental obsession that the next time is going to be different. I'm going to beat this some bitch. Next time I'm not going to do the same things that I did before. You know, next time I'm not going to jail. Next time I'm not going to spend the whole paycheck. Next time I'm not going to buy rounds for everybody to be the hero. Next time it's going to be different. Next time. But you know, while my mind was doing this, I had made sure that I knew where my toothbrush and cigarettes were at jails, because I knew I was coming back to that place. And the mental obsession was so bad for me that I could leave jail, and by the time I got to the first joint on the way home, I convinced myself that one would be all right. And I'd stop and I'd have a beer, and here we go, you know. The third part of the disease of alcoholism is the spiritual part of the disease. It has absolutely nothing to do with God or religion or anything else. It has to do with the fact that I become willing to pay a higher and higher price for my will, for my right to drink. And baby, I was willing to pay any price. You know, I was willing to fight purple cockroaches. I was willing to steal cars. I was willing to go to jail. I was willing to spend all my money. I was willing to get fired from jobs. I was willing to get to not be able to do anything in the Navy. I became willing to do anything as long as I could keep drinking, as long as I could keep hunting for that feeling that I had, that I got out there in Rouse's Point, New York, you know, and that I never could find again, but I kept hunting it anyway, you know. In 1964. My next to last child was born. Deidre. Deidre was born with cerebral palsy. Nobody knew what cerebral palsy was in those days. And but Deidre was going to live for 2.5 years. She died twice. Both times that she died, I was drunk. and they both times they brought her back to life. Now, by this time, I'm in Massachusetts. I'm working in a restaurant called Landolfi's, and I've worked my way down to fry cook and dishwasher. Now I'm down to where I should have started, you know. And every time I was making $2 an hour, and every time I got a 25-cent raise, I got drunk. And every time I got drunk, they'd take my 25-cent raise away from me and put me back to work. You know, they quit giving me raises. But we lived our address was 3 King Street in Peabody, Massachusetts, and the hospital was right next door. And that was for a reason, because this little girl was so sick. Deidre lived 2.5 years. She never weighed more than 7.5 pounds. And she was really, really, we fed her through a tube to her stomach. And it caused a lot of anguish in our household, of course. I found her on February 5th, which is 44 years ago today. I have mixed emotions when it comes upon my anniversary, of course. 44 years ago today, I found her dead in bed. And I picked her up and took her to the hospital next door. And we rushed her in an ambulance to Salem Children's Hospital. And about an hour later, they came out and handed me this little girl's clothes, a little bundle of clothes, and Deidre was gone. Nick got the funeral together and did everything that was necessary, got all the family together, made the funeral arrangements, and the next day he got drunk, February 5th. February 5th he got drunk, and I had another blackout. And I came, and my family at this time was, the family at this time was living in a third floor cold water flat, and the whole family was running around in this room. My wife was running around in the living room screaming this little girl's name, and I said, tomorrow I'll get some help. And so we went to see the preacher the next day that was going to have the funeral, take the funeral in, and I told him my sad tale of woe. He put me in contact with a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, remember, I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I know how this works. And I'm thirsty. So I said to my family, you got to go home. I got to take you home. I have to do this on my own. What I was really saying was I need a drink. And this is the only time. I remember my first drink, and I remember my last one. The first one is not a good sign. Remembering the last one is. My last drink was vodka and squirt, because, of course, you can't smell vodka, you know. On my way to see this lady, it's the only time in my life that I know that I had one drink. I went to see the lady, told her my sad tale of woe. She hooked me. She said, well, I'm going to get you some tranquilizers because you really had a problem. And she said, there's be about three. My husband's a doctor, and there'll be a couple or three tranquilizers. I forget what they were for you at the pharmacy. Of course, when I left, I had a whole bottle full. You know, and I went home. 6 o'clock that night, there was a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and there's a little Russian guy standing out there. He said, my name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic, and I understand you might be having a problem with booze. And I said, yeah, a little. You know, I hadn't had a bath in probably 3 weeks, and I had a haircut. I was wearing whites, so we were covered with spaghetti. I was working in Landolfi's. You know, I hadn't changed them either. You know. So he told me his story, and I identified with part of what he said, and he said, we're going to a meeting. Your wife and you are going to a meeting with me tonight. And that was on a Saturday night, and we went, a fella from Boston, we went to West Lynn, Massachusetts. West Lynn, the city of sin. I went to my first meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous. When I walked in the meeting of alcohol, that first meeting, I wanted the world to stop, and I wanted to get off. There was no hope for me. And there was no way that I was going to be able to survive on this earth that I could see. When I walked out of that meeting that night, there was a little bit of hope. I went to another meeting on Sunday morning. Frank took me to another meeting Sunday morning and another meeting Sunday afternoon and another one Sunday night. Monday was the funeral. Monday night I went to another meeting. My ex-wife stopped going. And I started to learn how to live one day without one drink. The pit, that hole that had been in my stomach every other time I stopped, I did not have. I asked for help to stay away from a drink, and I got the help that I needed because that hole disappeared. But what I had to do from that point on is that I had to attend a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the 44 years that I've been here, I've probably been to about 8,000 meetings. I asked my sponsor one time, I said, how do I know how many meetings do I have to go to? And he said, his response to me was, if you go to one too few, you'll sure as hell find out. But you'll never know if you go to one too many. And so I try to keep going to one too many. You know, I also told him, I said, you know, this damn Alcoholics Anonymous is nothing but a bunch of brainwashing. And his response to me on that was, and if I've ever seen a brain that needed washing, it's yours. You know. And so I'm still washing my brain. I have found out in Alcoholics Anonymous the key. His cousin died. My brother died in my arms about 2.5 years ago. He had Budweiser. His death certificate says cancer, but Budweiser is what killed him because he was living in a park over here in Clearwater because it was warm. Came down from New Hampshire. And he attended that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with me. My brother was better looking than I was. He was a lot smarter than I was. He had this huge IQ and everything else. But smartness has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with whether you stay sober or not, or whether anybody stays sober or not. The only reason that I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and my brother is in the ground is because of the grace of God. I am here strictly by the grace. It's nothing that I have done. For some reason or other, God has put this desperation in me to stay away from one drink for one day, no matter what. And I have screwed up everything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have done everything bass-ackwards in Alcoholics Anonymous except one thing. No matter what the hell was going on, I didn't drink and I went to another meeting. I don't care how bad I felt, how good I felt. No matter what the hell was going on, I didn't drink and I went to another meeting. I have been so damn depressed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, being depressed is just simply really feeling sorry for myself. You know, because I can really feel sorry for myself if I want to. You know, and to the point that I'm back there where I was before. I have to ask God to help me with this. You know, God has to help me stay out of this mess. When I am mad at people, when I am angry with people, when I turn it over, all it is my self-pity. You know, the other side of anger is self-pity for me. And I'm talking about me. I'm only talking about me. I have found out that the key to this for me, and my sponsor says it over and over and over and over again, the key to this is acceptance. I have to learn to accept whatever situation I am in. I have to learn to accept whatever people I happen to be with. You know, I have to learn to accept the situation as it goes. You know, and as I learn acceptance, to have acceptance for Nick, I have to believe that God is running my life. Now, the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, the last part of that step says that my life is unmanageable. I still do not manage my life. Whatever part of whatever part of my life that my wife doesn't manage. She's sitting back there. See, I can't lie because she's sitting out here in the audience. My higher power takes care of. You know. And I have come to believe that no matter where I am, no matter what's going on, no matter what I'm doing, that's God's will for me at that moment, whether I like it or not. You know, and my brother dying, that's God's will. That fella shooting his whole family and himself, that was, for whatever reason, that was God's will for them. You know, it's not for me to question why. You know? It's not for me to judge other people either. You know, each of us is recovering from our own set of circumstances. Each of us in our own way. In fact, if you get into the right circles, they still call me Sick Nick. You know, if people who really know me still call me Sick Nick, you know. Fella's keeping track of my time down here. He doesn't know, but we're not getting out of this meeting until about midnight, so if anybody wants to leave. It's funny, but you know, it's hard to squeeze 44 or 70 years into 45 minutes, because there's an awful lot that I can talk about Tampa. I ran a halfway house in Morgan Street. This is another story. I ran a halfway house in Morgan Street. We didn't have any money, so I went to Jim Walter Corporation, and I bid to build three houses in Okeechobee, but I don't know one end of a hammer from another, so I went to the Salvation Army, and I found a carpenter. And we ended up with 19 men in this house, and we had three houses to build in Okeechobee so we could eat. And I had an old Plymouth Valiant, and I stuck six of these guys in this Plymouth Valiant every Monday morning with enough money to get them through the week to pay the rent in the motel and to eat on, and expecting them back on Saturday afternoon. And, you know, the whole time we were working on those houses, none of those guys got drunk. Every week they went off, and they worked on those houses, and I came back. And we ended up building all three of those houses with only one carpenter. But when we got done, we figured it out. We'd only made 40 cents an hour, you know, because Jim Walters just didn't exactly give us a high price. But it kept the house going, you know. I paid these guys off. Every one of them got drunk. You know, my 19 went down to 2. But Nick came out of there without drinking. It's about time for me to wrap up, but I got to tell you a couple other things. I had Alcoholics Anonymous. Getting sober is not an easy thing. Getting sober can be a real happy journey if we want it to be, but it can be a very difficult thing to do. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm the one of the guys in this fifth chapter that had emotional and mental disorders, and I had some severe ones. I couldn't keep a job. I had 19 jobs the first 7 years I was in, not the first year, hell no. First 7 years I was in this program, I had 19 jobs. I've been divorced 4 times since I've been in this program. But Missy doesn't mind if I say that, as long as I tell you that we've been married for 20 years, you know, so it finally worked itself out, you know. She told me, she said, I don't mind if I'm not, it's all right if I'm not the first, as long as I'm the last, you know. And she's got a big enough stick to make it work, you know. But I look out here over the audience, and I'm the only guy here with white hair that I can see. The only thing that I can say to that is that there's snow on the roof, but there's still a little fire in the furnace. I don't know why the hell I said that either. I had a fella say one time, I heard a fella get up in a meeting one time, and he said, I came here to speak. You came here to listen. I hope you don't get done before I do. You know? And I'm about done. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to be here, to be asked to be here to speak. It's a really wonderful thing to look out and see as many people at this young age as there is here. And I know you probably all heard that. When we started our young, I got to tell you this story too. When we started our young people's, I thought I was going to get done, but I'm not. We started this young people's group. They didn't know what we were doing over here in Hyde Park, about 7 people. So I don't know what they thought we were, illicit sex or something. I don't know what the hell it was. But they sent, and it could have been if we got the chance. But they sent this guy over to check on us to make sure we were doing all right, you know. And they let us continue, you know. But Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can have fun. This is a serious damn thing, but you can have fun if you want to. You can smile and laugh and have a good damn good time if you want. You can go to that sober fest up there and do everything but drink and have one hell of a damn time. You know, as a group of people, we can have a damn time. Missy and I just sold a restaurant, the Blue Parrot Cafe on St. George Island. Sold it 4 years ago. Missy's a cokehead, a pothead, and a drunk. I'm a drunk. My partner was a crackhead. We hired the guy who ended up running my kitchen. Was a crackhead. I hired him 2 weeks out of prison when he put him to work. We started out with that restaurant. We were doing $133,000 a year. When Missy and I sold this restaurant, our half of it, we were doing $2.5 million a year. We had so many things going on in that restaurant at different times that was sometimes we'd answer the phone, the Blue Parrot Rehab, because there was so much stuff going on in there. But a group of drunks and drug addicts can do any damn thing in this world as long as they don't drink and do drugs. I can't smoke it. I can't drink it. I can't pop it. I can't inject it. I can't stick it in my ears, up my nose, up my you know what. But if I do that and I go to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can be anything I want to be. They told me when I came here that you cannot make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, but they did. Because I certainly was a pig's ear when I got here. You know, I may not be a silk purse yet, but I'm not a pig's ear anymore either, you know. God has a plan for you. He has a plan for me. He planned for all of us to be here together tonight. He planned for you to listen to me to talk. You know, I'm glad that y'all are here, and I'm glad I've been here too. Thank you very much.
I'm Zach. But Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all think the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm to stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 out of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like. So many remarks of necessity will be quite brief. Will be brief, very brief. Same difference. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not lose it all with the Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but we have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that earring member of the tongues, and if we must, use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complicity so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to help, which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.